September, October. Hanging tough. September 1st. I email Stuart. The Yanks have a cake schedule the rest of the way, and they start off by getting beat by Cleveland 22-0. That's some cake.
There ain't no steroids in humble pie, and that was a big pie.
I haven't been to Fenway since this terrific Red Sox run began. 8 in a row now. 21-7 for the month of August. And I'm astonished by how radically the atmosphere of the old park has changed. The glums and glooms of July are gone, replaced by a giddy nervousness that's not quite a playoff atmosphere. Seconds before Bronson Arroyo throws his first pitch, the PA announcer informs the sellout crowd that it's 77 degrees, the exact temperature of perfect childhood summer evenings, if I remember correctly. New England's first church of the baseball, unfulfilled, is once more ready to rock. My son and 3-year-old grandson are with me, the latter more fascinated by the hood blimp cruising overhead than anything happening on the field, and the Yankees are now almost close enough to touch. For the second night in a row, I wait for Anaheim's pitching, which has been largely responsible for taking them to 18 games over 500 in the fiercely competitive AL West, to show up. And for the second night in a row, it never does. For the second night in a row, Boston puts a 4 spot on the board in its half of the first. The difference is that we've got Bronson Arroyo going instead of Curt Schilling, and Arroyo is still years away from Curt Schilling's craftiness. Also, for some reason, the kid just doesn't pitch well in Fenway. Tonight, the Angels come back from what sportscasters like to call the early deficit and briefly make a game of it. After 3 innings, the score is tied 5-5, and Arroyo is gone. In the end, it makes no difference. The final score is 12-7 Boston, and my scorecard suggests that there are going to be some very tired Anaheim outfielders tomorrow. I see 14 fly ball outs and 5 strikeouts through 8 innings. Add in the 16 or 18 hits that had to be chased down, and that's an awful lot of running for the, Angels in the outfield. Anaheim came into Fenway on fire. After 2 consecutive poundings, I'd have to guess that the fire is out, and that when Bartolo Colon takes the mound tomorrow, he'd better have his best stuff working if he wants to help his team avoid a clean sweep. As for the Red Sox, it's now a nice balance. The team is 3.5 back in the division and 3.5 ahead in the wild card. The stretch drive has begun, and right now it looks as if we could go either way. Of course, I know what I'd like to see. The Yankees scrambling madly for that wild card berth and losing it on the last day of the season. I am a Red Sox fan, after all.
Tonight we're on the Monster, switching between 2 single seats and 2 standing rooms. The matchup of Arroyo versus former Sox Aaron Seeley seems to be in the Angels' favor, but Seeley comes out shaky and slow. Our guys are hacking at every pitch, and banjo hitters like Bellhorn are swinging for the fences. We score 4 in the first. The ump is squeezing Arroyo, and he gives 2 back in the second. We add another in our second, but the Angels tie it at 5 in the third, and Arroyo's history. Francona calls on Mike Myers to get lefty Darren Erstad. The crowd groans. The PA plays the theme from Halloween. Myers comes in and gets it done. Mike Socha gives Seeley an extra inning to find his bearings. Instead, he gives up 3 straight hits, and we take the lead. Like Mike Myers, Terry Adams has had his problems. But like Myers, he comes in with 2 down and gets his man, then settles in for 2 scoreless innings of work. One, I must say, belongs to Tech, who throws out 2 runners in the 5th. Scott Shields is their crummy middle reliever. We beat him like a rock, Millar sealing the win with a 3-run Coke bottle shot. And to cap it, after Johnny catches the last out on the warning track directly beneath us, he throws the ball up to me. The game's on ESPN, and when we get home, I've got emails from people who saw it. There I was, filling the screen, pointing and hollering, "Thank you," letting Johnny know, once more, that he is still the man.
September 2nd. Improbable or not, the Sox Express keeps rolling along. This makes 9 in a row, and we are rapidly leaving the land of the unusual and entering that of the out-and-out, please-pass-the-happy-gas unreal. No question tonight's game is the toughest of the lot, with Bartolo Colon throwing in the mid-90s and the Angels' offense struggling hard to salvage at least one game of the three. It is important that they do, of course, because of the swing that comes into play when the clubs in first and second play each other. Footnote: in this case, first and second place in the wildcard standings. There's a hell of a big difference between leaving Fenway 2.5 games out and leaving it 4.5 out. The Halos end up leaving it 4.5 out, mostly because baseball is also a game of luck, and Boston's is still running. It would have to be, wouldn't you say, for the Sox to go 2-for-14 with runners in scoring position and still manage to eke out the win. The tragical Mr. Lowe, who has been snake-bit most of the year, there have been innings when he's been forced to get not just 4 outs, but sometimes even 6, only has to endure a couple of miscues tonight, and Adam Kennedy is the beneficiary of both. One is an error by right fielder Dave Roberts. The other is a triple that center fielder Johnny Damon should have caught, and in neither case does the speedy Kennedy end up scoring. Lowe settles down after giving up single runs in each of the first three. The Red Sox are only able to touch up Colon for 4, also in the first three. Tonight, the Angel bullpen is superb, but 4 is enough. Between the 1st of April and the end of July, the Red Sox made losing one-run games an art, but now they have turned that around. By the time Keith Falk faces the last Anaheim batter of the series, 35,000 or so of the Fenway faithful, Stuart Onan and myself among them, are on their feet screaming, "Sweep! Sweep! Sweep!" Falk induces a harmless fly ball to Orlando Cabrera at shortstop, and the Standells launch into dirty water. Stuart and I, not to mention the rest of the faithful, have what we came for. It's unbelievable, but we have swept the Angels. Bring on Texas. And can I say we? I think I can, and in a wider context than just my Fenway friends on this clear and slightly fallish-feeling Boston night. According to the New England Sports Network, NESN, the first of the three-game series against the Angels drew the biggest ratings of any regular-season baseball game in the network's history. Seen in 18.5 million homes from Canada to Connecticut, it blew away all the big network competition. Said color commentator Jerry Remy, "I don't even know how to think about numbers like that." Only Remy, a Massachusetts native, cannot seem to say numbers. He says numbers. Footnote: and to Jerry, the Detroit Tigers are always the Tigers. In any case, the numbers only underline the meaning of the ninth-inning Fenway thunder I've now heard at the ballpark 2 nights in a row. This team has caught the imagination of New England. This year it took a while to happen, but it finally did. And the team has caught mine as well. This time they and we could go all the way. Not saying they will, the odds are still against it. But some team will become the 2004 world champions. And yes, this could be that team. They certainly have the tools. Christ, I hope I haven't jinxed them saying that.
We've won 8 in a row, and tonight we're going for the sweep against the Angels. A very good club. Yet when Derek Lowe stumbles out of the gate, the faithful grumble. Not this Lowe, not again. The Lowe who just misses his location and gets frustrated, puts runners on and gets distracted, gets ahead of batters and then throws too nice of a strike. The Lowe who kicks absently at the air like a bummed little leaguer after an RBI single. Colon is having an even worse night. It seems we have 2 on or bases loaded every inning, but he slows the pace of the game, doing a whole lot of yard work on the mound, and manages to weasel out of what should be big innings. After 3, it's 4-3 Sox, and at the rate the game's going, we'll be here till midnight. With 1 down in the Angels' 4th, Adam Kennedy flies one to Dave Roberts in right. Roberts isn't a right fielder by trade, and he tracks this one awkwardly, as if he doesn't quite see it, freezing and then waving at the ball as if it suddenly reappeared out of the lights. It hits his glove, then his leg, then the grass. Boo! It's tough to hear, since Roberts is an eloquent and genuinely nice guy and a recent addition, and he's playing out of position. But it's an important game, and the ball should have been caught. Still, I can't help reflecting that even in the best of times, the faithful are a hanging jury. Lowe walks the next guy. He's struggling and in even more trouble when Sean Figgins pokes a shallow liner to right center that should drop. The one real tool Roberts has is speed. He reads this ball perfectly, flashing in and diving, picking it cleanly with a nifty backhand. The runner on second is halfway home, and Roberts doubles him up easily to end the threat. A huge, deafening standing O, and gratifying as hell to see a good guy go from goat to hero in a matter of a few pitches. Lowe seems to take the lesson to heart, and battles into the eighth when he leaves to a standing O from the same folks, including me, who were shaking their heads a couple hours ago. We hang on for the sweep, knocking the Angels to 4.5 back. The turnaround's complete. Like Dave Roberts and Derek Lowe, with the August it's had, this team has redeemed itself, and the faithful are more than grateful. We're wild with hope.
September 3rd. Tonight's starter for Texas once pitched for Boston. Red Sox fans remember him well and not with affection. Because of all the home runs he gave up, mostly in a relief role, he became known as John Wayback Wasdin. Since then, he's been around, and he's improved. Not a lot, mind you, but enough to return to the show after a stint in AAA and land a starting gig with the Rangers, who have performed above expectations all season long and are only now beginning to fade a little in the wildcard race. We have Pedro Martinez on the mound, and on paper this game looks like a ridiculous mismatch. But I enter Fenway feeling really nervous for the first time since getting here for the second game of the Angels series. Yes, Wasdin is only 2-2, and yes, his current ERA is an unremarkable 7.01. But he remembers perfectly well what the fans here used to call him, and he'd really like to be the guy who ends the Red Sox streak. Also, Texas has a formidable hitting lineup. Guys like Michael Young, Kevin Mensch, Hank Blaylock, and Alfonso Soriano, who came to Texas in the A-Rod trade and has lit it up at Arlington, seem made for Fenway. All my worries about Wayback Wasdin turn out to be justified, and it doesn't help that two more Red Sox players are sitting wounded on the bench, David Ortiz, shoulder, and Johnny Damon, ankle. Wasdin is throwing some kind of heavy shit, footnote, a technical baseball term, that has our makeshift lineup popping up all night, and when Wasdin finally departs, he has given up less than a handful of hits. Luckily for us, one is a home run to Manny, and another is a home run to Bill Miller. Pedro strikes out 9 and faces only one serious threat in the 7th. With runners on 1st and 3rd and 2 out, Gary Matthews Jr. tests Jason Varitek's arm by trying to steal 2nd. Varitek passes the test. Orlando Cabrera slaps the tag on Matthews, and that takes care of that. Timlin and Embry tag-team pitch the 8th, and Falk closes out the 9th. The Standells are singing Dirty Water no later than 10 past 10, and the crowd goes insane. The Sox have won their 10th straight, and I find myself doing the funky chicken in the aisle with a 70-something woman I don't know from the Lady Eve. She's wearing a Curt Schilling t-shirt, and that's good enough for me. Did I say the crowd goes insane? That's wrong. They already went. It happened at approximately 9:50 p.m., when the scoreboard showed the Orioles beat the Yankees in the Bronx by a score of 3-1, reducing the Yankees' lead in the AL East to a mere 2.5 games. We've gained 8 in the East since the middle of August, a stretch of less than 3 weeks. Later in my hotel room, I learned that Kevin Brown, who started that game for the Yankees, broke his hand after being pulled. He punched the clubhouse wall in frustration. As so often happens in such battles, he fought the wall, and the wall won. At least it was his non-pitching hand, and he's vowed not to miss a start. But I wonder. For one thing, How's he going to wear a glove on that baby?
I never expected to see John Wasdin starting again in Fenway, but with the expanded roster, he gets another chance. And as the Sox complete their 15th shutout of the season and their 10th straight win, Adam Hizdu, the 26th man, the last one cut in spring training, makes his 2004 debut as a replacement right fielder. Like Wasdin, he's made his way back to the show, and if it's only for a short stay, still he's here, playing under the bright lights.
September 4th. Sarah McKenna, a Red Sox media rep, calls me while I'm still doing my morning workout and flummoxes me by asking if I'll throw out the first pitch before this afternoon's game. The Farrelly brothers, she says, creators of such amusing, if not quite family-friendly, movies as Dumb and Dumber and There's Something About Mary, are making a romantic comedy called Fever Pitch with a Red Sox background. And they want to recreate opening day, complete with sellout crowd and giant flag unfurling across the green monster. Footnote. Fever Pitch, based on a nonfiction book by Nick Hornby, describes a romantic triangle in which a young man must choose between his girl and his baseball team. He loves both madly, deeply, truly. That the baseball team turns out to be the Red Sox should come as no surprise. As pointed out elsewhere in these pages, the Red Sox is the team of choice for romantics. Can you imagine a poet writing an ode to the Yankees? As for lovers and the Yankees, good God. You might as well plight your troth in the lobby of the Marine Midland Bank as at Yankee Stadium, that symbol of baseball commerce. No, when it comes to romance in baseball, you pretty much have to have Fenway Park. Wrigley Field has its ivied outfield wall and a certain rusty exterior charm, but I think Fenway remains America's true field of dreams. I guess neither Ben Affleck nor Matt Damon is in town. And, of course, native son John Kerry is otherwise occupied this Labor Day weekend. I want to do it, hell yes, but I'm still slow about agreeing. Some of my reasons are purely superstitious. Some, although pragmatic, are about superstition. The purely superstitious reasons stem from having thrown out the first pitch at Fenway once before, around the time I published a book called The Girl Who Loved Tom Gordon. That was a work of fiction. But in 1998, the year before it was published, Gordon was brilliant. That was a fact. We lost the game, at which I threw out that ceremonial first pitch, and not long after, my memory wants me to believe it was at that very game, but surely that can't be right, we lost Gordon to an arm injury for the rest of the season. When the 2004 version of Tom Gordon shows up in these pages, he is, of course, wearing the uniform of the hated New York Yankees. And only a month later, I was struck by a van while walking at the side of the road and badly hurt. Certainly, if I had been a baseball player instead of a writer, my career would have been over. So the last time I threw out a first pitch, bad things happened. For the team, for my favorite player on the team, and for me. Those are the superstitious reasons I'm slow about agreeing to Sarah McKenna's proposal. The pragmatic reasons about superstition? Well, look, I know how superstitious the ballplayers themselves are, and the fans put them to shame. I mean, some guy actually risked his life to change that Storrow Drive overpass sign from reverse curve to reverse the curse, and the press only eggs them on. Lately, there's been a story on several TV stations about a local Massachusetts teenager who got two of his front teeth knocked out by a foul line drive off the bat of Manny Ramirez. Because this kid just happens to live in the house where Babe Ruth once lived, the curse is now supposed to be broken. Broken teeth. Broken curse. Get it? This is the sort of numbnut story you kind of expect from the local If It Bleeds, It Leads TV in the doldrums of summer. But then, holy shit, the local papers pick it up too. So of course some people actually believe it. Why not? There are still people out there who think Fidel Castro had JFK shot, and that cell phones cause brain cancer. So, one thing I know. If I throw out the first pitch and the Red Sox lose, if their 10-game streak ends this afternoon, I will get some of the blame. Because I'm not only a Red Sox fan, I'm creepy music here. New England's Horrormeister. And worse, what if someone gets hurt? Someone else to go along with Trot, Pokey, and Johnny Damon. Or the game ends with a bum call, or, God forbid, there's some sort of accident in the stands. Or what if the Red Sox go on to lose 10 straight, end up 9 back of the Yankees again, and 4 behind Anaheim in the wild card? Nor is this an entirely unbelievable scenario, with 3 coming up against Oakland on their turf, and then 3 more in Seattle, who has suddenly gotten hot. I'll get blamed for that, too. They'll say it all started when that bastard King threw out the first pitch on September 4th. So, of course, I say yes. 1 p.m. It's stifling hot behind the gigantic American flag, and I'm scared out of my mind. I can't believe I've agreed to do this. On my previous pitching adventure, I only had to walk from the Red Sox dugout to the mound a matter of 25 or 30 steps. Now I'll be walking in from the deepest part of the park. I am, in fact, positioned just beneath CLE in the out-of-town section of the left field scoreboard. My introduction finishes. Marty, my Red Sox minder, lifts the flag for me. I step out in a brilliant sunshine and off the warning track onto green grass. The crowd roars, and I have to remind myself that the PA announcer has cued them to go batshit, has told them that the cameras are rolling, and that they should make as much noise as possible. Still, that 40-second walk is a remarkable period of time for me, every second crystal clear. And as I approach the rusty red dirt of the infield, the exact color of old bricks in a factory wall, I cross at shortstop, where Orlando Cabrera will soon be standing, and where Nomar Garciaparra stood for so many years before him. I remember that I promised my daughter-in-law that I'd give the crowd the Manny salute. I do so without delay, cocking my free hand and glove hand like guns, and the crowd roars louder, laughing and delighted, giving me a verbal high five. It's probably the best moment, even better than towing the blinding white strip of the pitcher's rubber and looking in at Jason Varitek squatting behind home plate. Except maybe the moment before I throw is the best moment, because I can see him so clearly. There's no batter, of course, and he's not wearing the mask. His face is grave, as if he actually expects me to throw a 60-foot strike in front of 35,000 people. Me, who does his best work in an empty room with a cup of lukewarm tea for company. And I almost do. My pitch dips at the last second and hits that red brick dirt just in front of home plate. Varitek catches the ball easily and trots out to give it to me. It's beside me as I write this, a little red scuff on one curve, as the crowd roars its approval. Varitek is kind, calling it first a sinker, then a Hideo Nomo strike 3. Too cool. I try to shake his hand with my glove. That's how dazed I am. 3:45 p.m. The good times have rolled, and now my darker fears are coming true. Tim Wakefield, my current favorite Red Sox player, is on the mound, and he's getting lit up. When Terry Francona finally comes out and takes the ball, the score is 8-1, Texas. 4:25 p.m. The Sox make a game of it, at least. Mark Bellhorn hits a grand slam, and David Ortiz follows with a bases-empty round tripper. But in the end, Boston falls 2 runs short. There is even that bum call I obsessed about. A phantom tag on Dave Roberts, the second base ump sees as one half of the game-ending double play. Manny Ramirez is left in the on-deck circle, and the Sox streak ends at 10. I am 0-2 in games where I throw out the first pitch, and tomorrow the newspapers will blame me. I just know it. I email Stewart. I got a large charge out of throwing the first pitch today. Broke off a slider that hit the dirt in front of home plate. Varitek, laughing, called it a no-mo strike 3. And then we lost. Shit. But still a great game.
Saw you on the tube joking with Tech. Very, very cool. Taped it if you want it. Wake looked awful. What's his record in day games? Because I've seen him at least twice get shelled on beautiful Saturday afternoons. I called the bellhorn Granny and had a feeling Big Poppy would solo right after that. If Bill Mills' shot up the middle gets through in the eighth, Tech pinch hits with one out, but that galoot made a skate save. At least the Yanks lost. One more and the stand's over. Be sweet to bury the Rangers right here, right now. Mr. Shills on the hill.
September 5th. Bob Holler's Boston Globe piece on yesterday's game leads like this. Searching for scapegoats? Try Horror Meister Stephen King, who tossed out a ceremonial first pitch. Blame the Horror Meister. What did I tell you? Please, baseball gods, let Curt Schilling win today.
A weird glancing Sox experience today. We drive the 2 hours from Avon to Boston, and around game time we deliver Caitlin and all her stuff to her dorm at BU, then go over to Beacon Street for a farewell lunch. Fenway's less than a block from us, and fans headed for the rubber game against Texas stream past, decked out in their Red Sox best. So not only do we feel lost, losing Caitlin, it feels like we're going the wrong way, or doing the wrong thing, as in some unsettling, ominous dream. On the way home, 3 now instead of 4, we listen to the game unfolding farther and farther behind us. Schilling throws well, and we hold a 4-1 lead until the 7th, when Gabe Kapler adds 2 more with a bases-loaded single. It turns out that we need them, as Francona unwisely gives Schilling a chance at a complete game. Michael Young, again, hits a monster shot, and it's 6-3 with one down when Falk comes in. He gets an out with his first pitch, then gives up a single, a double, a single that makes it 6-5, until finally, as we're just pulling into the driveway, Bellhorn snares a knee-high bullet to save the game. Yay, yay, yay.
9:45 p.m. It was closer than it should have been. The Rangers turned a 6-1 laugher into a 6-5 nail-biter in the top of the 9th. But in the end, Father Curt and the Red Sox prevailed. The Yankees also won on a bases-loaded walk, and the Angels are winning. But for tonight, at least, I don't care about the other guys. My personal curse has been lifted. Of course, all that superstition stuff is the bunk, anyway, and we all know it. And with that said, I can take off my lucky shirt, turn my pillow lucky side up, and go to bed. I email Stewart. Did you see today's Globe? I took the hit for the loss. I knew I would. Superstitious idiots. That's twice I've tossed out the first pitch, and twice they lost. Think I'll get the call in Game 7 of the World Series? Steve, just call me Hideo King.
Hey, Hideo, you didn't give up the 3-run dinger to Michael Young. And Bellhorn's comeback granny was some kind of magic. For a game we were basically out of, it was damn close. The way today's was for Texas. Yeesh, Falk had absolutely nothing. We'll take the W and plant it on their grave. On to Chokeland. September 6th. While some of the faithful grouse that we've become more and more like the Yankees, signing free agents rather than developing our prospects, the team we most consciously resemble is Oakland. Theo and Bill James tend to follow the tenets of Moneyball, valuing on-base percentage above other indicators. And in our 2 seasons under their reign, we've approached the playoff chase like the A's, staying close until the All-Star break, making a few deals, and then charging. Beyond absorbing Billy Beane's philosophy, we also appear to be importing players he's already poached from other teams. Mark Bellhorn, Johnny Damon, David McCarty, and Keith Falk are all recent A's, as is manager Terry Francona, Oakland's bench coach in 2003. So it's no surprise that the A's are our constant competition, and that the games we play with them are tight, a situation that ironically does not benefit a Moneyball club, since defense, speed, and a closer are less highly prized in Billy Beane's universe, but a small ball team like the Angels, or a more traditional slugging club like the Yankees. Tonight, out by the East Bay, Mark Kotze, who lost the last Sox A's game with his bobble of a Bill Miller double on the track, solos twice off Arroyo early. But Bronson settles down, retiring 11 in a row. In the 4th, Manny and David go back-to-back against Barry Zito to tie it. The game stays that way till the 7th, when Bill Miller and Dave Roberts hit RBI doubles. The A's rally to make it 4-3 after a terrible call in the 8th. Manny clearly traps a line drive by Kotze, yet the ump calls him out. But in the ninth, their lack of a pen shows, as Chad Bradford and the ever-unreliable Arthur Rhodes combine to give up four runs, three of them on a David Ortiz bases-clearing double, and we win 8-3. Thank you, Moneyball. The Yankees, meanwhile, were scheduled to play a doubleheader against Tampa Bay in the Bronx. But due to Hurricane Francis, the D-Rays were late getting to the stadium and missed the first game. Yanks general manager Brian Cashman immediately lobbied the league office for a forfeit. The league turned him down, I'd hope with a look of disbelief. So while in Florida, the storm has torn people's homes and lives apart, the Yankees' only thought was to use it to pick up an unearned win. Now that's class.
September 7th. It wasn't that long ago, at the end of this season's Fantasy August, in fact, that Red Sox writers and commentators, not to mention your run-of-the-mill bleacher creatures, were saying that Boston's postseason chances might hinge on how well they could do in the upcoming 9-game stretch against the big fish of the AL West, before leaving those sharks to swim and hopefully to bite one another as seriously as possible in their own tank. Most hope for 6 wins at most, 2 against the Angels, 2 against the Rangers, and maybe 2 against the Oakland Athletics. Many partisans would have been satisfied with 5. Few, I think, would have guessed at our current position. 6 wins and 1 loss, with 2 of the 9 games set left to play. When the Red Sox last visited Oakland during the playoff series against the Athletics in the fall of 2003, they left a bunch of pissed-off A's and A's fans behind. The same was true following last night's rematch, the only difference being that we have to play them again tonight instead of next year. And tonight the chief object of the A's ire will be on the mound. That would be the tragical Mr. Lowe, who supposedly made an obscene gesture toward the Oakland bench after striking out the final player of the game. The animus of last night's Oakland Coliseum attendees was directed not at any Red Sox player so much as it was at the ump, who ruled Mark Kotze out after Manny Ramirez appeared, from the ump's perspective, to have made a rolling, tumbling catch of Kotze's dying quail line drive. Manny actually caught it on what's known as the trap hop, a fact his diving body obscured from the umpire, who fearlessly made the call anyway. Manny himself acknowledged this in the locker room after the game. "I knew I didn't catch the ball," he said, "but the umpires say I catch the ball, so the guy's out." He then shrugged as if to add, "Tough luck, Mark, but we gotta just keep going." To add insult to injury, Kotze made almost exactly the same play on a Red Sox dying quail of a liner later on in the game. Only this time the ump saw the ball hit the ground and ruled the batter safe. Kotze raised his arms in frustrated body English even a baby could read. "Aw, come on, give me a makeup call here, Blue." No makeup calls for Oakland, not last night anyway, and it probably wouldn't have helped. In the end, the game just wasn't that close. That didn't stop the angry Oakland fans from hurling their trash into the outfield, however. It was a sight that filled me, I admit, with childish glee. I had zero sympathy for their outrage, given the ump's honest effort to make an honest call, not so soon after the blown call on Dave Roberts that ended our game against Texas 3 days ago, and probably, if I'm to be honest, in no case. Footnote: with this one utterly unforgivable exception, don't ever let me hear of an official or a player who takes money to tip a game in which millions have invested their hopes in the energy of their collective imagination. Blown calls are, after all, a part of the game, and the fans' rage somehow made this one even tastier. "That's right, ya babies," I thought, watching the hot dog cartons and empty beer cups rain down. "The umps are relaxing in the officials' room, probably soaking their tired feet. So take it out on your grounds crew. Go on and chuck that shit. Why not?" Are Oakland fans coming to hate us the way we hate the Yankees? There's an interesting thought.
Trot comes off the DL today, and Pokey. And Johnny, who's been out with a strained pinky, when in doubt, pinky out, is back in the lineup. Scott Williamson, who's been gone a long time, throws batting practice to Trot and may be ready soon. Mr. Kim, however, appears done for the year. The Paw Sox finished their season yesterday, as did Cesar Crespo and Brian Daubach, who both contributed to the big club early on. And Theo says they're putting together a conditioning program so the $10 million man and his 11 innings of work this year will be ready in the spring. Of course, there's nowhere to put all these guys. The roster, like the dugout, is overflowing. Uke hasn't seen action in weeks, or McCarty, or Ricky Gutierrez. No one's going to rock the boat, though. The team's doing too well. Tonight, Johnny celebrates being back in action by leading off the game with a home run. It's Derek Lowe's first appearance in Oakland since his alleged crotch-tugging in the direction of the A's bench after clinching last year's divisional playoffs, and the crowd lets him know it. He scuffles early, as usual, but Gabe Kapler clocks a two-run shot for a 3-0 cushion. Billy Miller makes three highlight reel stops at third, and once again we bulldoze their number four starter Mark Redman for a 7-1 win, making a 7-1 in our gut-check stretch against Anaheim, Texas, and Oakland. September 8th. I'm primed to stay up late and watch the Pedro-Tim Hudson series finale, hoping for the sweep, but Hudson can't find the plate. And after three, it's 7-0 Sox, and he's gone. And we haven't really even hit the ball yet. What do you do when the one strength of your club fails you? You lose. We sweep the A's at home after sweeping them in Fenway in July. Even better, the Angels lose, so we're 5-up in the wild card. And the rain left over from Hurricane Francis, in a fitting revenge, wipes out the Yanks' D-Rays doubleheader. So we're only 2 back in the East, and with the makeups, their rotation's a mess.
September 9th. The Red Sox offense didn't beat Tim Hudson last night, and Pedro Martinez can't exactly take credit either. After walking the first three batters of the game, four in the first inning, and giving up a double to David Ortiz and a single to Jason Varitek, Hudson pretty much did the job on himself. Meanwhile, the Yankees' current series with the Tampa Bay Devil Rays, footnote, the once more hapless Devil Rays, and please God may they, or the troublesome Albertos, not poke a stick in our spokes as we race down this season's home stretch, a seemingly endless exercise in baseball existentialism, during which the D-Rays never win and the Yankees never seem to gain ground in the standings, is continuing this afternoon, with the New Yorkers leading in the first game of a doubleheader by a score of quite a bunch to one. I could check and get an exact score, but it hardly seems worth it. Based on my last peek, I can tell you that A, there's hardly anyone in the stands at the stadium, and B, Rocco Baldelli looks like he wishes he were playing for the Tokyo Sunflowers, assuming there is such a team. After last night's rainout and the Red Sox win in Oakland, the gap in the AL East shrank to a mere 2 games for the first time since early June, and reading the sports pages of the New York tabs has become a wonderfully cheering pastime for Red Sox fans. The Post and Daily News baseball columnists, used to a steady diet of Yankee triumphs down the stretch, have started to sound like holy rolling revival show ministers, warning that the horsemen of the apocalypse are on the horizon. Behold, I saw a pale horse, and on him was Manny, and he spake, saying, "Hey man, we gotta just keep going." Meanwhile, on other fronts, the hapless Devil Rays will be more hapless still if Ivan, third and worst hurricane to menace Florida in the last 30 days, blows away their juice dome down there in Tampa. Like a certain unlucky Jew, they may be doomed to simply wander, dragging their dusty equipment bags behind them, playing everywhere and always batting in the top of the first. "We once had a home," they'll tell those who will listen. "It wasn't very full, and most of the folks who showed up were old, many equipped with shunts and pee bags, but by God, it was ours." In Foxborough, the New England Patriots, proud winner of exactly one preseason game, prepare to defend their Super Bowl title. And on I-95, just north of Augusta, Maine, at a little past noon and in a driving downpour, the remains of Hurricane Francis, or so the radio assured me, I saw an oak tree blazing with orange leaves. Football, autumn colors, hurricanes, omens of the end. Hurry up and finish your 4 games with Seattle Red Sox. Hurry up and come home. It's almost time to deal with the Yankees. I get an email from Stuart.
Maybe because all this is happening late at night, way out west, there isn't the crazy celebrating like last week. But it almost seems too easy, too calm. It's quiet. Too quiet.
It's like people are getting used to it. If so, bad people. Bad people. Ungrateful, bad people. Or maybe, who knows, they're just not as crazy as we are. Also, they are away. And some people do have to get up and go to work. Not us, I mean, but some people.
Tonight, in the top left corner of the country, Seattle throws a rookie lefty I've never heard of, Bobby Madrich, whose route to the bigs included time in the independent leagues, the outlaws of the minors, while Tim Wakefield takes the hill for us. Wake came out flat in his last start, our last loss, so he's due for a solid game. Wrong. The Mariners score early and often. And when a fly to the track goes off Manny's glove in the fifth for a 2-run error, this one's done. We lose 7-1, while the Yanks sweep a doubleheader from the D-Rays, the first game of which has an officially reported attendance of 0. 0, as in no one. 0, as in one less than the guy sitting at his desk writing this. If the Yankees win and no one sees it, does it still count? September 10th. I email Steve. I'm definitely making the Tuesday game next week versus Tampa, and if you're not using the ticks, I could see myself there Wednesday and Thursday, too. There just aren't that many games left. Here on Monday, I went to the Rockcats' last game of the year. After they won, the players tossed their hats and batting gloves and all the balls in the dugout and even the leftover bubblegum to the crowd. And I realized that once the season's over, that's it. It's fall and then winter. I didn't like the feeling one bit, and I guess I'm doing what I can to stave it off.
You're so right. Winter's coming. I felt a change in the weather the day after Labor Day.
Losing 2 straight to the last place M's with Schilling going isn't likely, and I'm uncharacteristically certain of this one from the start. Seattle keeps it close to the fifth, when David Ortiz sneaks a line drive homer over the wall, and then, after an error by backup second baseman Jose Lopez with 2 outs, Bill Miller singles, Dave Roberts doubles, Johnny Damon triples, and Mark Bellhorn singles. The next inning, Manny, who started our scoring with a solo shot, piles it on with his 17th career grand slam, and Schilling cruises to become the major's first 19-game winner. Meanwhile, in Baltimore, Javier Vasquez melts down, walking and hitting batters with the bases loaded, and the Yanks go down hard. So we're 2.5 back. Anaheim wins, and the A's lose again, so the Angels are a mere game off the pace in the West. With the unbalanced schedule, the Angels have 6 games remaining against the A's, and a chance to make them our wildcard rivals.
September 11th. Manny Ramirez hit home runs 39 and 40 last night to amble past Boston's Dwight Evans on the all-time list and further enhance his MVP chances, although for that to happen, Boston will almost certainly have to win the American League flag. Boston didn't look particularly good against Seattle's collection of battered veterans and freshly called-up farmhands in the first of the team's 4-game series, and Tim Wakefield suffered for it. But the whole team appeared to be ambling in that game, probably a natural enough result of having just finished an 8-1 tour of duty against Oakland, Texas, and Anaheim. Father Kurt took matters in hand last night, thank God. He righted the ship, as the sports cannibals like to say, and bagged his 19th win in the process. The Angels, currently 5 back in the wildcard race, are now the only other contender for that ticket to the postseason dance. Footnote: that could change if Oakland loses its hold on first place in outer weird Pacifica. But even if the A's do drop to second, our position vis-a-vis the wild card won't change much. For the record, I think Oakland will hold on and win the West. The Angels have 19 games left, 2 against the so-so Chi Sox, 7 against the schlubby Seattle Mariners, and 10 against good teams, including 6 against Oakland. We, on the other hand, have 6 games left against the Yankees and 8 against Baltimore, who has played us tough all year. The moral of this story is simple. We gotta just keep going, man. I email Stewart. We kick their ass, all right. Another granny for Manny. And it was 1 inning after I went to bed. As for being there, Owen has talked me into going down to at least 1 game and then driving back afterward. Meantime, another day off the schedule. Another day closer to the Yankees.
If you're going to catch just 1 game, make it Thursday's, Kurt's first crack at 20 wins. Arroyo threw well against the Mariners in his other start against them, and got screwed out of a W when the pen fell apart. Tonight, he's wearing some of the ugliest dirty blonde white boy cornrows I've ever seen, but he pitches beautifully, that hard curve of his dropping off the outside corner, making hitters lunge. Manny homers again, and Mark Bellhorn. Kevin Youkilis starts at third to give Bill Miller a breather, and by the late innings, Pokey Reese, David McCarty, and Ricky Gutierrez all get some playing time. In the ninth, we're up 7-0 when Adam Hizdew sees his first at-bat as a Red Sox. He looks anxious and awful, chasing pitches away. He's down 1-2, and I think how much that would suck, striking out in your 1 at-bat all year. Hizdew lines a double to the wall in left, knocking in a run. So he's batting 1,000 and slugging 2. When the Sox have to declare their playoff roster, knock wood, some of these guys aren't going to be on it. We keep having to make room on the expanded roster for people coming off the DL, like Scott Williamson last night. And with all the guys we added in midseason, I wonder if guys like McCarty and Pokey won't be going to the party. And can we keep Dave Roberts, Trott, and Kapler as backups? Someone's going to be left out, the way Dauber and Cesar Crespo have already been left behind. September 12th. I email Steve. Did I tell you my theory that Napoleon Dynamite is about the Sox pitching staff? Eck is Uncle Rico, wanting to time travel back to 1982, while Napoleon is the lost and tragical Derek Lowe.
Who is the nerdy older brother? Bronson Arroyo would be my guess. Peace out, Napoleon. Cornrows indeed.
I was actually thinking of Wake for the brother, but you're right, Arroyo's cornrows might win him the role. Who did a Manny, Pokey? And I did see a Vote for Pedro t-shirt at the park the other day. Speaking of voting, Mr. Schill should have the inside track on the Cy Young, and Manny sure as heck looks like the MVP. My too quiet prediction comes true, as righty Gil Mesh scatters 5 Red Sox hits for a complete game 2-0 shutout. Manny sabotages our best scoring chance in the first. With 1 out and 2 on, he forgets how many outs there are and gets doubled up off second on what should be an easy sack fly. Derek Lowe's only mistake is a 2-run shot to Raul Ibanez. Time of game, 2 hours, 22 minutes.
What can you say? Guy pitched a great game and Manny ran us out of an inning. Oh, that crazy Manny. At least it'll take more than this 1 game to cost us our dream. But 3.5 back of the Yankees. And housed by the Angels, white-hot Cologne, as per the Angels' website, over Chicago, 11-0, back to 5 up in the WC. And do you know what? I think the D-Rays might put a hurtin' on us.
D'Lo deserved better, and be sure the GM of the O's has taken note of his last 7 starts. So we're where we were on Friday, just 2 games closer to the finish line. With Petey and Mr. Schill slated to go against the D-Rays, I'm optimistic. Just got a hit. I wonder how much Manny's little fugue states will hurt his MVP chances. What a weird series he had. He clouts a bunch of big dingers, including that granny, makes a great flying karate kick give-up-the-body grab in the corner, then muffs that can of corn on the track, and today he forgets how many outs there are. It's like Sun Ra said. Space is the place. Somewhere I'm missing a game. Our record says we have 20 left, but I only count 19 on the sked. Must be a rain date in there somewhere. Ah, found it. We've got a doubleheader in Baltimore on the next to last day of the season. So that means of the 20 games we have left, 8 are with the pain-in-the-ass O's, and 6 are with the Yanks. so we had better beat the D-Rays.
I don't like the sound of that, man. Too easy to see the headline. Angels in as wild card. Tejada sinks Sox. You think? Say, nah.
Nah, they'll be meaningless. Our starters will be Abe Alvarez and Frank Castillo, or whoever needs the innings for his bonus. But you're right, Tejada will hit 4 homers. Talk about some fans who should continue to be pissed. The new and improved O's didn't even make 500. Plus, I'm looking for the Angels to knock off the A's. Be nice to see a team with real fundamentals overcome their injuries and eliminate the Moneyball guys. September 13th. In the mail, a gift from Steve. The Year of the Gerbil by Con Chapman, a chronicle of the 1978 pennant race. The Gerbil, of course, was just part of Bill Spaceman Lee's nickname for then Sox manager Don Zimmer. The whole name was the Mad Gerbil. On the cover is a shot from the TV feed from the one-game playoff. The center field camera keying on Bucky Dent just after his fateful swing, Mike Torres starting to follow the ball up and to his right. Torres, I'm surprised to see, is wearing Roger Clemens' number 21. Another good reason to retire it. I email Steve. Thanks, man. The title alone had me laughing. Though you know by the end I'll be grim-lipped, bumming once again at Mike effin' Torres and Bucky effin' Dent. And this year sure looks like a photo negative of 78. We just have to catch the Yanks at the wire and let Mark Bellhorn do the rest.
I saw the cover of this week's Sports Illustrated, and my heart sank into my boots. If you don't know why, and I'm sure you do, Google Sports Illustrated curse.
I believe Tommy Brady and the Pats survived it, so maybe Mr. Schill can too. At least it's not the chunky soup curse. That's a career ender. Terrell Davis, Kurt Warner. Keep your eye on Donovan McNabb. If we gather all these curses, Titanic, Bambino, SI, and still win, will folks shut up about them already? And will we get extra points for degree of difficulty, like overcoming all our injuries?
September 14th. The Yankees got roughed up again last night. Roughed up bad, this time by lowly Kansas City. The final score of that game was 17-8. And this morning, the New York sports writers will once more be eating their gizzards out about the Pinstripes' lack of pitching. Lovely. The Red Sox, meanwhile, only split with cellar-dwelling Seattle, which is a long way from wonderful. But the road trip is over. 4 more games are off the schedule, and we're coming back to Fenway Park almost exactly where we were in the standings when we left. 3 games behind the Yankees in the East, 4.5 ahead of the Angels in the wild card. Furthermore, we're looking at 3 with the hapless Devil Rays, and the Sox have been strong against them this year. So, at least until we meet the Yankees on the 17th, all's okay with the world, right? Wrong. There's a problem. A big one. Father Kurt is on the cover of Sports Illustrated this week. That's the problem. He's standing on the mound at Fenway with his arms spread, and every letter on the front of his uniform clearly visible. How could they? With all the other stuff we have to worry about, how damn could they? Because while there's no evidence of the curse of the Bambino, other than the failure of the Red Sox to win the World Series since 1918, and they are not alone in that, there's plenty of evidence that the Sports Illustrated curse actually exists. Footnote. Unlike, let us say, the supposed Campbell's Chunky Soup curse, where I can only find 4 football players, Terrell Davis, Kurt Warner, Jerome Bettis, and Donovan McNabb, who actually suffered injuries after appearing in the ads, despite all the rumors. 2 games after his cover appearance on SI, Kurt Warner suffered an injury that sidelined him for 5 games. Although in Warner's case, I'm at least willing to admit the possibility that Campbell's soup may have been a contributing factor. 1 day after Anna Kournikova appeared on the SI cover, she was bounced from the French Open, her earliest exit from a Grand Slam event in 3 years. In his first Monday Night Football game after his cover shot, Howard Cosell went from hero to zero by referring to a Redskins wide receiver as that little monkey. After Dale Murphy of the Atlanta Braves appeared on the cover, The Braves dropped 14 of their next 15 games. Other sufferers of the SI jinx have included Tom Watson, Kirk Gibson, George Brett, Pedro Martinez's brother Ramon, and ex-Red Sox franchise player Nomar Garciaparra. After Nomar, stripped to the waist and looking most righteously buff, appeared on the cover, he went down with a popped wrist tendon and played hardly at all during the first half of the season. And now, in addition to all our injuries and our far-from-secure lead in the wild card, in addition to a 3-game bulge for the Yankees that won't seem to shrink any lower than 2 games, I have to cope with the near certainty that Curt Schilling will not manage to win 20 games in the regular season, but will remain stuck on 19 instead. Martinez, Wakefield, Arroyo, and the tragical Mr. Lowe will have to take up the slack. Thanks, Sports Illustrated. Thanks a pantload. You guys suck.
Behind Fenway, at the corner of Yawkey Way and Van Ness Street, sits the players' parking lot. 4 hours before game time, the Sox take over Van Ness, barricading both ends and evicting any parked cars. By then, a sizable clump of autograph hunters is already waiting. There's no way you can get close enough to the players' Mercedes and Volvos and Range Rovers as they pull in, or Gabe Kapler's and Kevin Millar's chromed-out hogs, and the tall fence surrounding the lot is lined with a heavy green tarp so you can't see in. But 100 feet down Van Ness, there are 3 horizontal slots cut into the fence about thigh high, and as the players walk from their rides to the clubhouse entrance, some will stop to sign. The slots are uncomfortably close to glory holes, with all that that implies. The only way to tell who's coming is to kneel on the concrete, press your cheek against the metal edge, and peer sideways through the slot, like the opening of a pillbox. Today, I'm the first one there, and stake out a spot at the end of the first slot. Position is everything. Some guys will sign just a few and then break off, leaving fans at slots 2 and 3 grumbling. I've also chosen a weekday for my hunting because weekends people are packed 6 and 7 deep, and I'd feel like a heel claiming a spot before some little kid. Little kids also have no qualms about stepping on you or crawling over your back. As the other hunters show up, I realize that compared to them, I am a little kid, a rank amateur. They're mostly pros, dealers who owe each other money and merchandise. They bring bat bags full of big sticks, boxes of balls, albums of 8x10 glossies, high-ticket items they can sell on eBay. As we stand there waiting for the Sox to arrive, they're cutting deals and boasting of recent acquisitions, trading information about upcoming shows. "What are you working there?" one asks me. "Hat? Couple of balls?" I try explaining that the hat's for me, to wear, but it's impossible for him to understand that I'm just a fan. The coaches arrive first, together. No one wants them but me. No one seems to know who Eno Guerrero is, or care. I'm psyched to get Adam Hizdew's autograph on his Paw Sox card, while they just shrug. Likewise, when the middling Devil Rays players come walking right past us on Van Ness, the pros let them pass. Damian Rhodes, one calls Damian Rolls, used to play for Baltimore, mixing him up with old closer Arthur Rhodes. When Jason Varitek signs, everyone behind me mobs the slot, crushing me down against the fence, reaching their merchandise over my shoulders and past my ears. Because all Tech can see of us are our hands, the pros get a first autograph, bounce out and grab a second bat or ball from their arsenal, shove in again and snag another. Double dipping, it's called. And while frowned upon, especially when not everyone gets even one autograph, it's the pros' bread and butter. "How many Varitex you get?" 3. "Ha, I got 4. I get 1, and I'm happy. Thanks, Tech. Johnny Damon signs for a long time. Like Tech, he always tries to sign for everyone, and is always polite and nice. For a guy who looks like a wild man, he's surprisingly soft-spoken and has impeccable manners, even with the pushiest fans. His parents should be proud. Pokey signs, he doesn't always, and Mark Bellhorn. The pros gripe about some other players who blow us off, Schilling and Wake especially, though Wake, I've heard, only signs for charities, and you have to respect that. They say Pedro and Manny are almost impossible to get out here, and that they hardly ever even see Orlando Cabrera. Doug Mankiewicz takes the time to sign. and Doug Mirabelli, Dave McCarty, Ricky Gutierrez, Billy Miller, Dave Roberts. The hat looks great. Silver Sharpie on black. By 4 o'clock, I've got half the club. If I came tomorrow and Thursday as well, I'd be able to get most everyone. And even after 3 hours of being squashed and elbowed and having to listen to the dealers brag and haggle, I know I'll be coming back. Because while most of these guys are pros and hustling hard, there's still something kid-like and hopeful about them. The rumor is that next year, when the team enlarges the clubhouse, the slots in the fence will be no more. I hope that's not true, because for a fan like me, this is as close to the players as I'll ever get.
September 15th. Pedro Martinez has pretty much owned Tampa Bay. The Red Sox have pretty much owned everyone while at Fenway Park, and the hapless Devil Rays were sending a 20-year-old rookie named Scott Kazmir to the mound last night. The result, of course, was a comfy Tampa Bay win. At one point, Kazmir struck out 5 in a row, and the only bright spot for the faithful was an 8th-inning home run from the newly returned Trot Nixon. We have fallen a game further behind the Yankees. The Mariners beat the Angels, at least. There is that much joy in Mudville. And I find myself doing 2 things this morning to start the day. One is marking another game off the schedule. The other is wondering why Father Kurt ever agreed to be on the cover of Sports Illustrated. I get an email from Stuart.
Thanks for the use of the seats. Let me just warn you, when the sun goes down, it's fall. Couldn't have been more than 50 degrees out there. I had to buy a pricey sweatshirt to keep from shivering. The offense didn't create much heat either. Mason says it's the return of the pre-July 31st Sox. I think it's the usual we-don't-have-to-hit-for-Pedro virus. Funny how that works. We didn't hit for Clemens either. He was always leaving in the 7th, tied 2-2.
Number 1. It is a return to the July Sox. Number 2. It is the curse of Sports Illustrated at work. Number 3. It was Cabrera, not Noma, who ended the game first pitch swinging in the bottom of the 9th. Sign me, told you so, boy.
Hey, if we're expecting to win that game down 3 with 2 gone in the 9th, we truly are some cockeyed optimists. Ain't no curse when you lose and deserve to, and we did. The only reliever who stopped the bleeding was Liscanic, and by then it was too late. It's not just saves we're missing, it's holds. Our middle guys, like the Yanks the last 3 years, are our biggest weakness, and have been since spring training.
Not win it, tie it.
True, play for the tie at home. Still, we were losing from the very first batter. Tim Wakefield has struggled to be generous in his last few starts. Tonight, he gives up a run right out of the gate. Mark Bellhorn's 2-run shot off D-Ray starter Dewan Brazelton in the bottom of the 1st gives us the lead, only to have Wake give it back. In the 4th, we scrap for 2 more, but Wake immediately surrenders a pair. It's not that they're shelling him, it's just the usual fallout from the knuckler. Some walks, a wild pitch, 5 stolen bases. That's it. When Kevin Millar's 2-run monster shot gives us a 6-4 lead in the 5th, Francona turns to Curtis Liscanic. He threw okay last night, right? 3 batters later, Tampa AAA call-up Jorge Cantu ties the game with a blast high off the Sports Authority sign. Not to be outdone, in the bottom of the inning, Lou Piniella counters by using 4 pitchers to worm out of a bases-loaded no-out jam. It almost works. All we get is 1 on a Manny Sack fly. We tack on another in the 7th, when Trot's grounder goes through shortstop Julio Lugo's legs and pinch runner Dave Roberts motors around. We're leaving men on all over the place, but Timlin sets up and Fulk closes neatly, and we bag a long, ugly 8-6 win. Since the streak, we've been playing terrible ball, splitting the last 6 with cellar dwellers. And yet, with the Angels and A's losing once again, we're now 5.5 up in the wild card, our biggest lead yet, with only 18 games to go. In other words, we're closer to the postseason than we've been all year.
September 16th. I email Stuart. They're talking about taking Tim out of the postseason rotation. That's okay. If we keep playing this way, postseason won't be a problem. I have never gone to bed feeling so depressed after a win. They hit everything we threw at them, and they ran our socks off. Blah.
Maybe this'll cheer you up. Before this year, Tim A. was 5-2 lifetime in the Metrodome, 5-2 at the Coliseum, and 5-3 with a 3.32 ERA at Angel Stadium. I wouldn't pull him just yet. You know how streaky he can be. If he gets unhittable after October 1st, we could be wearing some big rings. Have hope. Tonight's the kind of game we've overlooked in the past. The last home game with a patsy before heading down to the stadium. Before the advent of Curt Schilling, we'd be scrambling to get our rotation in order for the Yanks. Try to throw a number 4 or 5 guy and get burned. With Schilling going tonight, we're confident of a quality start, and can rest assured that Petey will be going Sunday. So this one's the mismatch we want, the one we've paid for. We jump on D-Ray starter Mark Hendrickson for 3 quick runs. Lou's going to play us tough, though. With one down in the first, he's got a guy warming. It's pointless. Schill wants his 20th. His splitter's nasty, and his location is spot on. We're up 6-0 when Kevin Millar hits a monster shot to spark a 5-run 7th, and we're set for the big, but probably hurricane-rainy, weekend in the Bronx.